righty. Are beginning a new study tonight. Still dealing with these various personalities, Bible characters. And so far we've dealt with Abraham and with Joseph and Moses, three great characters in the Bible. And hopefully we have learned from them. But as we announced, we're going to turn our attention to Esther now, beginning tonight. And so we're going to look at her, and we'll just study the book of Esther. And I'm not really concerned with time, as we have said, or the length of these studies, but it happens that with Esther, we won't take as much time because there's only 10 chapters that tell the story of her life and the situation that is set forth in the book. So it's relatively short. And we'll just work our way through it. Esther, of course, will be the star of the study, but she'll have some co-stars as well. Mordecai, of course, plays a prominent role in the book. Now, in the setting of Esther, we remember, of course, that God, and we've talked about this many times, God, of course, chose the Jews to be his people and set them apart, and all they had to do to remain in good standing with God is obey his law and not turn to the gods of wood and stone and all of that, the various gods of the people. But the problem is they failed in the very beginning after they became a nation to drive out the Canaanites from the land. And, of course, we're mindful of what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, verse 33, that bad company corrupts good morals. And that is certainly true. And never was that more true than with the Israelites. It is amazing the depths that they fell to from a religious or spiritual standpoint, the things that they were willing to do just because they were influenced by all of these foreigners and all of their false gods that were in the land of Canaan. We would have hoped that they would have had more of an influence on the Canaanites than the other way around, but again, Paul warned about that in 1 Corinthians 15. And so because of that, God had set before them life and death. You remember Moses talking about in Deuteronomy 30 and other places. But they chose death. They went after the way of false gods. And so they were taken off into captivity. And, of course, they spent those 70 years there of in captivity. But then finally, Cyrus was raised up by God, and he set forth the decree to set the Jews free, to let them go back home. And you remember that they did so, but only a remnant of them returned home, about 50,000 at first. There were actually three different occasions when a group of Jews returned home, but between the first time that the people went home under the rulership of Zerubbabel and the second time under Ezra, between those two periods of time is when the book of Esther takes place. And so Esther and her family then are part of the group that remained in Babylon after the decree was set forth for the Jews to go home. And, you know, we're not really surprised by the fact that some of the Jews stayed behind. And there's no question that some Jews stayed behind maybe because they got too attached to some of the false gods and the heathen ways of the foreigners there. You remember, by the time they were set free, we always refer to it as Babylonian captivity. But by the end there, the Babylonians had been overthrown, and so they're actually under the Persian rule at that time. But they got attached to that lifestyle. But that wasn't the case with all of them that stayed behind. Again, they got settled there in the foreign land. But if you look at, turn over to Jeremiah. In the book of Jeremiah, we read of God's instruction to them, chapter 29. Of Jeremiah. And it's interesting that God, you know, God was punishing his people, but he wanted them to survive this ordeal in captivity. And so he gave them some instruction as to what they were to do when they were over there. And so in Jeremiah 29 at verse 4, we read about it. This is what it says. Jeremiah 29 at verse 4, it says, "Thus says the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, to all the exiles whom I have sent into exile from Jerusalem to Babylon, build houses and live in them, plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters in marriage that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there and do not decrease." Of course, he's talking about taking sons and daughters among themselves, not encouraging to marry the foreigners, but among themselves so that they would not decrease. "But seek the welfare of the city where I have sent you into exile, and pray to the Lord on its behalf and for its welfare. For in its welfare you will find your welfare." So that's kind of interesting there. God basically saying, when you're over there in captivity, you build houses, live in them, and plant, and just carry on life there in this foreign land. In other words, settle in, because they were going to be there for a while. And again, he wanted things to go well for them. Well, we're not surprised then that what happened with the Israelites when they were over there during this 70-year period of captivity. Well, they settled in, didn't they? And so at the time then when the decree is set forth, some of them were born there. And, you know, that was their life. But it's clear from the book of Esther that many of them continued to live as Jews and had great faith in God and would not compromise. Now, again, we have no idea of what the numbers would be and who compromised and you know, how many. No doubt several did. But the point of it is, from Esther, we learn that even the Jews who are outside of Palestine, God was watching over them, and they had a relationship with God. It wasn't just the remnant who returned. Even those who were scattered outside of Palestine, God watched over them, and so that's clear from the book of Esther. Now, as we, again, then, so we know when the setting of Esther is. So here they are, Esther and her family, and all these other Jews who stayed behind. And between the first group and the second group that went home is when we read about all of this. And it's the grandson of Cyrus. You notice in verse 1, "Now in the days of Ahasuerus, he is the grandson of Cyrus the Great, and the son of Darius then." And so that's the attempt of the to give him a Hebrew name there. The Persian name is very difficult to read. That's the Hebrew name. Xerxes is the Greek name, and most know him as Xerxes. And so that's probably what we'll call him most of the time, unless we're reading in the text. And he wasn't a great king, as we see in this opening chapter. And this opening chapter really kind of just sets the stage. Obviously, in the opening chapter, Esther isn't even introduced. But important things are introduced that will play a part in the rest of the book. Like we begin to understand from the first chapter, why it is that Esther God had to raise her up and put her in the position that she was in. What we're going to find, what the book, most of you know, the book basically is all about averting a great crisis in the history of the Jews here. Like their very existence comes under threat. And so the story of how it is that they came under threat and how they averted that, that's what the book of Esther is all about. And so a lot of that, we see that what's happening here in the very first chapter, and then it's played out in the rest. And so what kind of individual was this king? It says, now in the days of the Ahasuerus, Ahasuerus who reigned, now watch this, from India to Ethiopia, over 127 provinces. Now you think about that. This is a very powerful man. He is the most powerful man on earth right now. This is, if you remember from Daniel and the dream that Daniel had, this he's ruling over the Medo-Persian Empire. So he would be the second one in that great statue that is set forth in Daniel's dream. Inferior to the first, but still a great empire. Like you picture in your mind, or if you can't go home and get a map out and look at the, you know, all the way from India to Ethiopia, that would cover the entire Fertile Crescent area, and Egypt would be engulfed in that, and Northern Africa, all of that. He by himself was the controller of all that territory. And so very, you know, very powerful man. And, you know, he wasn't a great man either. You could tell as we start to read this, in those days when King Ahasuerus sat on his royal throne in Susa, the citadel, in the third year of his reign, he gave a feast for all the officials and servants. He began reigning about 486 B.C. So now this book then opens up about 483 B.C. If you think about that, it's about 50 years after the decree was set forth by Cyrus. And so that's the timing of all of that. And so he throws this feast. The army of Persia, and the Media, and the nobles and the governors of the provinces were before him, while he showed the riches of his royal glory and the splendor and pomp of his greatness for many days, 180 days. He's showing off his riches. What would you call that? Yeah, bragging. He was a proud, boastful individual. And so for 6 months, who has a feast for 6 months? This is a king with responsibilities. Now, it is not to be assumed that he's just letting his responsibilities go. He's not. This is actually kind of a mixture of business and pleasure. And so he's, now this isn't stated in Esther, but from various historians, Herodotus is a Greek historian of repute. And in one of his books, he describes all of this to a T so that we know what he's talking about. And he tells us that what Xerxes is doing here is he's planning to invade Greece. And the reason he's doing that is because earlier, about 490 B.C., his father, Darius, was defeated by the Athenians. He attacked Athens, but he experienced an embarrassing defeat. And Xerxes now wants payback. And so what he's doing is he's meeting with all these generals and all these people from throughout his province and putting together a game plan to attack Greece, as well as trying to talk them into it all being worth it, because not a few aren't on board with it. Not everybody wants to attack Greece. It was, there was really no need for it. It was just a matter of revenge, basically. And so he is showing all of his riches and everything and just trying to impress them and get everybody on the same page so that they can, so that they could attack Greece at this time. So that's really why this is a 6-month situation. And I don't think we should get the idea like this, just 6 months of nonstop partying going on here. It's, you know, his kingdom, he has opened his kingdom and the capital for these various individuals to come and go as he has these meetings and plans for this war against Greece. And so, but it goes on for 6 months. And again, he's showing off, as it says here, his splendor and pomp, and his greatness, for many days. And then it says, and when these days were completed, the king gave for all the people present in Susa, the citadel, both great and small, a feast lasting for 7 days in the court of the garden of the king's palace. Now, this feast was of a different nature. And, you know, one thing, you see, he's a very liberal king. And no doubt the people loved him because of these kind of things that he would do. And so now he's having a feast for everyone. You know, even the nobodies in the kingdom who don't have quite the authority as all the other group. He's having a feast for everybody now there. And again, you notice the description. It lasts for 7 days in the court. And it says at verse 6, there were white cotton curtains and violet hangings fasted with cords of fine linen and purple to silver rods and marble pillars and about the couches of gold. And it just describes all of this that, I mean, the kingdom was vast and the capital was just extravagant. And he's showing it all off. It's even excessive. Like, you know, he's a materialistic king that has all these things on purpose, you know, built all this stuff up, and now he's showing it all off, and then now he's having this feast after all of that. And look at verse 7. Drinks were served in golden vessels and vessels of different kinds. In other words, I mean, you had all of these vessels of gold that they were drinking out of. And when's the last time that any of you drank some water, whatever, out of a golden vessel? And each one was different. For all of these different vessels of gold, that's how wealthy Persia was at this time. And he's the head of it all. He was just filthy rich. And now he's showing it all off. Now they're drinking in all these different vessels. And the royal wine was lavished according to the bounty of the king. So it's the best wine they had to offer, the king's wine. And drinking was according to this edict. There is no compulsion. They didn't have to do it. Not everyone, it was, you know, he wasn't forcing people to drink. It was customary, though, that those who drink, that they would follow in line with the king. Whatever he did, they would do. If he drank a lot, they would drink a lot. And so all of this, again, even with the common folks, you know, when you're trying to as a king, you're going to war. You want to get all the generals and everybody on the same page, but you want the popular vote too, don't you? You want everybody to be on your side. You want it to be a popular move. And that's what he's doing. It's interesting. Turn over to the book of Proverbs for just a second. Proverbs 23. And this would be a warning to all of them, but really a warning to us too, not from a lesser standpoint, obviously. We don't appear before kings and that sort of thing. But we are in the company sometimes of those who have authority. Like people, you know, sometimes go on business trips and things of that nature or whatever. But watch the advice that the wise man gives here. And notice how, at least from the ESV, how dramatic the wording is here. It says, when you sit down to eat with a ruler, observe carefully what is before you. And put a knife to your throat if you are given to appetite. Give me another translation. I've only just read this from the ESV. Anybody have a different translation? Steve, I know you have a different one. You put a knife to your throat. I mean, obviously it's figurative, but he's just getting the point. If you are enticed at all, when you sit down with the ruler and you're enticed by all the extravagant luxuries that are set before you, you need to do something quick about that and snap out of it, because usually the ruler is up to something. And so he said, you put a knife to your throat if you are given to appetites. Do not desire his delicacies, for they are deceptive food. Well, that fits Xerxes completely, doesn't it? That's exactly what he's doing. He's trying to bribe everybody, get them on his side, and get everybody on board to go to a useless war that's not even necessary, just because he wants revenge for his father. And he does, obviously, he's, again, so boastful and so interested in power, he does want more and more, wants his kingdom to continue to advance. And the Greeks are kind of a thorn in his side. And so, you know, all of that is involved. And so he is... He just really trying to bribe the people. All right, so he's involved in all of that, and then it says, for the king had given orders to all the staff of the palace to do as each man desires. So you want to drink, drink. You don't want to drink, don't drink. If you want to drink, drink as much as you want, just like the king. And so that's what they're doing. Then verse 9 says, Queen Vashti also gave a feast for the women in the palace that belonged to King Ahasuerus. And so interesting there, just kind of almost a footnote that the queen also threw. And so it seemed like there was a kind of the two feasts, the men in one and then the women in the other, although it wasn't uncommon. Most of the time in Persia, there wasn't any law against men and women feasting together. In fact, it was very common for that. So this is not meant to say that there wasn't any women at all in the other one, but Queen Vashti had her own feast going on as well. Now, something happens that... all of this is, it kind of sets the stage to how it is that Esther ended up being queen in the first place. And so that's what is about to be revealed. It says, on the seventh day, when the heart of the king was merry. What does that mean? He was drunk. What do you do when you get drunk? Dumb things. You make bad decisions. And I mean, that's why the Bible over and over warns us about strong drink, and even describes, again, in Proverbs. In fact, if you turn over, I know you're familiar with this passage, but it's worth reading. Back over to chapter 23 of Proverbs, and at verse 31, it says, Proverbs 23 at verse 31, I always like this, the vividness of this passage as well. It says, do not look at wine when it is red, when it sparkles in the cup and goes down smoothly. In the end, it bites like a serpent and stings like an adder. Your eyes will see strange things and your heart understand perverse things, or utter perverse things. I'm sorry. And you will be like one who lies down in the midst of the sea, like one who lies on the top of a mast. They struck me, you will say, but I was not hurt. They beat me, but I did not feel it. When shall I awake? I must have another drink. You read that little description and you think, why would anybody want to get drunk? And now, of course, even today, I mean, how many stories after stories have been told about, a story after story has been told about drunkenness and what it does to individuals, how it affects you physically, how it destroys your body, but also the pure stupidity that it sends you into. You start doing silly things, most of which you don't even remember later. And you know that's going to happen whenever you get drunk, or at least it's very, very possible. And what do people do anyway? They keep on drinking. They just do it anyway. And it has really the attitude of this individual. Whenever I wake, you know, I want to wake so I could do it all over again. Like, just foolishness. And that's what happens. And so here it is, this great king. Remember, this is the most powerful man on earth. But he loves to drink. He loves to get drunk. And now it's gone to his head. And so now he's drunk. And when he is drunk, when he is merry with wine, he commanded a human, Biztha, Harbonia, Bigtha, and Abatha, Zethar, and Carcass, the seven eunuchs who served in the presence of King Ahasuerus, to bring Queen Vashti before the king with her royal crown, in order to show the peoples and the princes her beauty, for she was lovely to look at. And so, you know, now he's drunk. And now he spent 6 months showing off his kingdom, showing everybody all the great things that he had. And there's only one last thing that he can show off: his wife. And she's a beautiful woman. And so now, in his pride, he wants to parade her out there before all of these men. Now, we don't know all the details of this. And it's all over the map on exactly what was going on here. And as we read on, we find right away that she, verse 12, King Vashti refused to come at the king's command delivered by the eunuchs. And so the question arises, why? Why wouldn't she come? And so that's when the speculation comes into play. And some of it is really, you can conclude by some common sense. Some of the extreme things, like there's some who believe that he was asking her to come out naked with nothing on, only her royal crown. And that's a very popular position, as a matter of fact. I think it was Josephus who first, he claimed that according to an Aramaic translation, that's what it specifically says. And through the years, then various rabbis and stuff took hold of that, and that's become the popular position. But really, there is no real evidence in the text that is what he was asking her to do. And so now, no matter what, however you view it, I mean, she wouldn't come for a reason. At the very least, if you take the most conservative approach, he was still trying to parade out his wife before a bunch of drunken men to show off her beauty. And there's some report that what would happen, it's more than a report, a custom. I said earlier that it wasn't uncommon for the Persians, when they had a feast, again, to have a mixed group of men and women. The husbands would bring their wives, but whenever the strong drinking began, and whenever they would bring in concubines and prostitutes, even the wives would leave. And that was very, very common. We're not given all the details here, but we know what Persians would do. Persians would do what they would do. And so that was a very common thing. And if they did what they usually do, then it would be a very disrespectful thing. All the wives have now left. And the king in his drunken state wants his queen. Now there's no one but men there. He wants her to come out and show her beauty. And she said, no, I'm not doing that. I refuse to do that. And what do you say about that? Good for her. Good for her. You know, you know, this is the most powerful man on earth. And we haven't even really described, there's a lot we could say about his overall character. He was a man who was given to temper tantrums. We know that from historical records of things that he has done. He, you know, like most monarchs who had that much power, he was a loose cannon. He, at one time, he wanted his brother's wife and her daughter. And they refused. And the next thing you know, his brother was dead and his brother's wife was mutilated. And his brother was very loyal to him, by the way. Like it was a Persian custom that whenever a king went out to war, he would always make preparations for his death and assign ahead of time, just in case, the one who was to take his throne. And the one that Darius set forth to take his throne was Xerxes' brother. And then Xerxes bought him off with a bunch of lavish gifts and things. And so he, you know, but he became a very important person in the kingdom and was very loyal to his brother until his brother wanted his wife and his daughter. And they said, no. Can you believe the nerve of him saying no to that? He said no, and he showed up dead. And again, his wife mutilated. You think Xerxes, was he a good man? Not so much. And do you think his wife, you think Vashti knew about his temper tantrums and his greed and desire for power, all of that? Of course. How do you think a man like that would feel when in front of everybody he sends these seven eunuchs out, go get my wife, and the message comes back, no. How do you think that was going to make him feel? We don't have to guess. We're told, aren't we? Verse 13? Nope, back up a little bit. The end of 12. But Vashti refused to come at the king's command, delivered by the eunuchs. At this, the king became enraged, and his anger burned within him. And so, I mean, you know, you think Vashti could predict that would be the outcome? She risked her life. It's amazing that he didn't have her killed. Now, there's one thing we know. I said earlier that the year was 483 B.C. We know that at this time, and this is why, you know, you wonder, you know, what did it mean when he just wanted people to see her beauty? Well, at this time, Artaxerxes his son who became king after him, and you know, he plays a prominent role in the Jews with the Nehemiah and whatnot. Vashti was, we're told, was pregnant with Artaxerxes at this time. So that's an interesting little side note, isn't it? Could that have been the reason he didn't just have her executed? She was carrying his child at the time. I don't know that was the case, but we do know that Artaxerxes was born in 483, and that was the time. So that's the timing of it. But for whatever reason, he doesn't have her executed. He's filled with rage, but Instead, it says, then the king said to the wise men who knew the times, for this was the king's procedure toward all who were versed in law and judgment. The man next to him being Karshina, Sithar, and he goes on to mention it, but now this is what one of the things. Remember I said you can find a lot of things happen in this first chapter that just give us some information throughout the book. This king can hardly make a decision by himself. And so he's constantly listening to the wise men that he has on his side. Now all presidents and whatever have counselors and that sort of thing. But it's like this guy can't hardly even make a decision without that. The Jews got to the point of being exterminated because he took some bad advice, maybe from these very men named right here. And it just seemed like he'd get advice and then just go with it without thinking it through or, you know, weighing it or being like a king and deciding, okay, I've listened to you, now let me make, he just take the advice and go with it. And that's what got the Jews in trouble. And so that's what, we'll finish this in a couple of weeks, but that's what he's doing here with Vashti. He takes their advice of what should happen with her. And so it leads to the rise of Esther ultimately. So we'll pick up there then here in a couple of weeks.